Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment, we're going to be taking a look at some aspects of the O.J. Simpson case that have not received a whole lot of attention. As I speak on the evening, and this is being recorded, by the way, on February 16th of 1997, everyone is wound like a clock saying that O.J. was guilty and this, that, and the other thing. I have talked about the O.J. Simpson case at considerable length, and leaving aside the massive problems there are with not only evidence but testimony, and leaving aside the exculpatory evidence which was never presented, leaving aside the witnesses who could have cleared O.J. Simpson but who were threatened with death if they came forward, and above all, leaving aside the monstrously distorted media coverage of the O.J. Simpson case, which has led the vast majority of Americans to conclude incorrectly that O.J. Simpson was guilty. Most Americans do not know, for example, that the grand jury refused to indict O.J. Simpson, that the judge in the civil case would not let O.J. Simpson try on the gloves, and that, in fact, there is not only a mountain of evidence, but that there are serious, serious problems with virtually every piece of physical evidence in this case, much of it obviously manufactured. And beyond that, the prosecution witnesses and witnesses for the plaintiffs almost all changed their testimony and changed them fundamentally with regard to both the criminal and civil cases. The media, however, have not reported this, and so as a result, the public has a very distorted view of what happened. It is my opinion that this may very well be a domestic intelligence operation, a type of operation known as a PSYOP, which has been launched by the Nazi faction of our intelligence community. And in fact, there is a Nazi faction of our intelligence community, and in my opinion, it is dominant at this stage of the game. I can also appreciate to the uninitiated listener, and that's not meant to be condescending or patronizing in any way, what I have just said will appear to be utter madness, and that is altogether comprehensible, given the distorted nature of the media coverage. What I'm going to be talking about in the next two segments are not only some aspects of Mark Furman's background and behavior that have escaped public attention to a large extent, but also some background concerning the place where Mark Furman moved to, a tiny little town in Idaho called Sand Point, which has become an epicenter of the white supremacist movement at this point. And there are serious questions about the possibility of Mark Furman himself having been involved with white supremacist groups, including possibly white supremacist groups within the LAPD. Some of the material that I'm about to relate will be by way of review for the veteran and dedicated listeners. We're going to begin by taking a look at some information from a book called Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. The book was authored by Stephen Singular, that's spelled just like Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, and published in softcover by Dove Books, copyright 1995. The author, by the way, Stephen Singular, is described on the back flap as, and the back cover, I should say, in the following terms. Stephen Singular is a Denver-based journalist whose first book, Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, became the basis for the 1989 Oliver Stone film Talk Radio. His previous books include the New York Times bestseller A Killing in the Family and Charmed to Death. And what we're going to begin with is a discussion of serious indications that Mark Furman may very well be a white supremacist or even a Nazi. This information surfaced during an internal affairs investigation of Mark Furman, and the information was brought to light by a couple of assistant DAs, and some of the allegations made by fellow officers and some of the disturbing indications concerning Furman's behavior were brought to the attention of Marcia Clark by fellow members of the district attorney's office. However, Citizen Clark chose not to pay attention to this information. Turning now to Legacy of Deception, we read, "The event surfaced after the Furman tapes were aired in public, when it was revealed that the LAPD had conducted an internal affairs investigation of the detective in February of 1995. According to the report that came out of this investigation, in August or September of 1994, two detectives, Walter Purdy, P-U-R-D-Y, and David Lamkin, L-A-M-B-K-I-N, were in the L.A. Criminal Courts building where they'd come to file a case. They saw Deputy District Attorney Lucian Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, whom they'd known for years in the hallway, along with another Deputy DA, Julie Sergojian, S-E-R-G-O-J-I-A-N. Coleman approached Purdy and said, 'Hey, have you heard the latest thing the defense is trying to pull?' After telling Purdy that the Simpson defense team was alleging Furman had planted a bloody glove at the defendant's estate, Coleman laughed. Purdy looked at her very seriously and said, 'I wouldn't put anything past him,' unquote. Coleman was taken aback by his response because she'd regarded the allegation as a joke. During the same conversation, the report states, Purdy told Sergojian and Coleman about an incident that occurred in 1987 while he was assigned to the WLA, or West Los Angeles, station. Coleman understood that Purdy married a Jewish woman. That's quote. Coleman understood that Purdy married a Jewish woman. When Purdy came back from his honeymoon, he found numerous swastika insignias painted on the inside of his locker at the West L.A. station. Purdy told him that Furman's fingerprints were found on the inside of his locker. Sergosian was walking through the hallway when Coleman told her to stop and listen to something. Purdy stated that the matter had been investigated with fingerprints and photographs taken. Furman was determined to be responsible based on his fingerprints being found inside the locker. Furman received either a reprimand or some days off, unquote. While they were talking, Coleman also heard Purdy call Furman a Nazi, unquote. And still more about allegations by fellow officers that Furman may have white supremacist and even Nazi inclinations. When Deputy District Attorney Julie Sergosian was interviewed during the investigation, she confirmed what Coleman had told the investigators about Purdy's remarks in the criminal courts building in August or September of 1994. Sergosian, the report says, questioned Purdy about the matter of his locker. Purdy stated that the matter had been investigated with fingerprints and photographs taken. Furman was found responsible for the incident based on his fingerprints being found inside the locker. Purdy continued, stating Furman was very interested in Nazi memorabilia and had a Nazi uniform. Furman supposedly belonged to some type of Nazi collector's club. Unquote. In addition, information surfaced during this same investigation of Furman, which indicated that he may have known Nicole Brown Simpson, or certainly was boasting of having seen her breast enhancement surgery, quote, up close and personal. Returning to Legacy of Deception, we read, the detective, the report says, heard the story from someone who had been at a party with Furman. Furman had bragged he had seen Nicole Simpson's, quote, boob job, unquote. The party was some kind of non-LAPD event and was not a barbecue. Burke concluded from the detective's remarks that Nicole Simpson and Furman had been lovers. Coleman heard the same story from another detective from 77th Division. Sergosian learned of the story in October or November of 1994. Sergosian walked into the adjacent office where Deputy District Attorney Ellen Burke worked. Burke related another story about an officer who had spoken with Furman at a barbecue some years back. The officer had been at a barbecue for West L.A. officers with Furman. Furman stated that he had seen Nicole Brown Simpson's new, quote, boob job, unquote. Furman indicated that he saw the breast augmentation, quote, up close and personal, unquote. These allegations would tend to be supported by an odd piece of information that surfaced during the course of Mark Furman's testimony in the preliminary hearings for the O.J. Simpson trial. And while there's never been any confirmation of any kind of relationship, sexual or otherwise, that is objective confirmation that surfaced in the media, at the same time there were reports, as Stephen Singular discusses in his book Legacy of Deception, and as we talked about in an interview with Stephen Singular available from Spitfire, a tape duplication service that I'll tell you about later, there were numerous officers within the LAPD who had heard these same stories, and apparently Furman had made these sorts of statements, correct or incorrect, to numerous officers. There were even accounts that Mark Furman was Nicole's, quote, personal cop, unquote, on the LAPD. Whatever the substance of those allegations, it should be noted that Mark Furman appeared to have an uncommon knowledge of the custody status of O.J. and Nicole's children. And Stephen Singular writes in Legacy of Deception, as I studied the documents Douglas, that's Carl Douglas, a member of O.J.'s defense team in the criminal trial, as I studied the documents Douglas had sent, three things leaped out at me. All were in Furman's testimony. The first was on page 68, where he told the court about something that had passed through his mind in the immediate aftermath of the murders. I would be concerned with the younger Simpson children and the ex-husband, since they, Nicole and O.J., still had joint custody of the children, unquote. How, I asked myself, did he know about this joint custody arrangement? Was it common knowledge at the West Los Angeles Police Department? Or had he been told that by Nicole herself? No one on the defense team had asked him these questions. That is indeed interesting, and may have something to do with the allegations coming from fellow officers that Furman and Nicole knew each other quite well, perhaps even intimately. One of the things that blocked further investigation of some of the allegations concerning Mark Furman's white supremacist connections was the fact that Judge Lance Ito, himself married to Peggy York, the highest-ranking female member of the LAPD at that time and Furman's former watch commander, would not permit LAPD personnel records to be entered into evidence. It should be noted that allegations concerning Nazi inclinations on the part of Mark Furman also surfaced during the course of his military career. He was reported to have painted swastikas on the lockers of black Marines as well. However, Judge Ito, again married to Mark Furman's former watch commander, would not permit any of this information to be introduced into the criminal trial. Turning now to Newsweek magazine of March 6th of 1995, we read an article in the Society section entitled Furman in the Crosshairs, subtitled O.J., the Controversial Cop, Faces New Charges. And skipping down, we read, in another incident Newsweek has learned, an African-American policewoman gave sworn testimony that portrayed Furman as a racist and a sexist. As part of an administrative board hearing in 1984 and 1985, Tia Morris, now a detective who outranks Furman, testified that Furman told her she, quote, didn't belong, unquote, on the force. He suggested that she become a secretary or a dancer on Soul Train. And the following is perhaps even more significant. At the hearing, Morris identified Furman as the unofficial leader of a notorious cop clique called Men Against Women and the ringleader for another less well-known group that went by the acronym WASP, for White Anglo-Saxon Policemen. We should note that the LAPD and LA County Sheriff's Department do have a history of penetration by white supremacist groups. There was, in 1991, a fairly well-known, at least in the LA area, incident concerning the Vikings, basically a white supremacist group within the LA County Sheriff's Department. We should also note that Dennis Mahone, a prominent white supremacist leader and former Ku Klux Klan leader with connections running over to Europe, had also been recruiting from within the Los Angeles Police Department. We should also note that Mark Furman, as we will discuss later on in this segment and in the next segment, after his retirement from LAPD and even before the trial, the criminal trial was over, had moved up to Sandpoint, Idaho, a tiny little town with a population of about 5,200, which has become one of the epicenters of the white supremacist movement in the United States. An interesting piece of information also surfaced during the course of the airing of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes, which also, by the way, were entitled Men Against Women, which was the head of this misogynist clique within LAPD, which was the name, I should say, of this misogynist clique within LAPD that Furman, according to a fellow detective, was the head of. We're going to turn now to a book called Blood Oath, subtitled The Conspiracy to Murder Nicole Brown Simpson. This book was co-authored by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers. I've dealt with this book at considerable length in the past. I've interviewed Stephen Wirth by himself and in conjunction with other authors, including Stephen Singular. The book is basically about an apparent or at least alleged white supremacist conspiracy to murder Nicole, frame O.J. Simpson, and the back cover of the book reads as follows. Blood Oath is the story of an ongoing conspiracy that began with the attempted AME church bombing in Los Angeles and the targeting of prominent African Americans for assassination by an elite strike team of white supremacists. The motive? To divide Americans and incite a race war. The battlefield? The American judicial system. The timing? The 10th anniversary of the assassination of liberal talk show host Alan Berg in Denver, June of 1984, their last big success. By the way, I would note that Stephen Singular, who authored the book Talk to Death about the murder of Alan Berg, was contacted by a source within the Los Angeles legal system because of his work on the murder of Alan Berg and told that basically white supremacists and neo-Nazis were not on the fringes of society anymore but had entered into the system and were doing a great deal of damage. Hence Stephen Singular's involvement in the case. Continuing with the back cover of Blood Oath, the action, the execution of Nicole Brown Simpson, a white woman married to a prominent black hero, the informant, codenamed Skinner, and the plot between the covers of Blood Oath, a conspiracy to murder Nicole Brown Simpson, again published in softcover by Rainbow Books and copyrighted 1996. The informant Skinner, who maintains he was actually a part of the elite white supremacist strike team that liquidated Nicole and Ron and framed O.J. Simpson, also maintains that the Oklahoma City bombing was pulled off by this same group and that this same group, basically that guilt over the Oklahoma City bombing and also the loss of some of his white supremacist comrades in that bombing led him to come forward with the information. In Blood Oath, the authors present an interesting statement by Mark Furman in the course of the Laura Hart McKinney tapes. And turning to page 258 in Blood Oath, we read, in addition to impeaching the preceding testimony of Detective Furman, Professor McKinney's tapes reveal an individual with a racist attitude scornful of the LAPD who has a thought process very similar to that of the kinsmen of the cause. Detective Furman's remarks include, quote, black members of the city council should be lined up against a wall and effing shot, unquote, and, quote, the NAACP and the civil liberties union groups that support many black causes should be bombed, unquote. When referring to the KKK, the next part is particularly interesting. When referring to the KKK, he says, quote, "I'm the Grand Dragon, the Hood," unquote. Again, when referring to the KKK, he says, quote, "I'm the Grand Dragon, the Hood," unquote. It remains to be determined exactly what he meant by that, but in light of some of the indications of white supremacist activity on his part and the charges by a fellow detective who now outranks Furman, well, Furman doesn't rank at all, he's retired from the force, that he was the de facto ringleader of a white supremacist group called WASP, white Anglo-Saxon policemen, the statement that, quote, "I'm the Grand Dragon, the Hood," unquote, I think warrants closer scrutiny than it has received to date, or, in my opinion, is ever likely to receive. One of the things that's interesting about Blood Oath is that it contains information which was presented to the authors by this anonymous informant codenamed Skinner, who maintains he was part of the team that actually dispatched Ron and Nicole and framed O.J., and that information later turned out to be corroborated from other sources. One of the pieces of information that Skinner provided to the authors is discussed on page 65, and it concerns allegations by Skinner that members of the LAPD or LA law enforcement had warned O.J. Simpson that his life was in danger, and that some of the detectives who had warned O.J. were sympathetic to the white supremacist cause, with indications of white supremacist activity within LA law, within the ranks of LA law enforcement, quite probably involving Mark Furman in some capacity. This is interesting and quite possibly significant. It grows in significance with information that will be presented later in this and the next segment. Skinner relates discussion among the various members of the white supremacist group that, according to Skinner, liquidated Nicole and Ron. By the way, that group is called CAUSE, an acronym for Christian Aryan Underground Special Enforcers. And in Blood Oath we read, "Now get this," one of the members talking to another in a planning session, "now get this, some of our sympathetic LAPD detectives have warned O.J. Simpson that his life is in danger." One more time, "Now get this, some of our sympathetic LAPD detectives have warned O.J. Simpson that his life was in danger, is in danger." This is interesting because this information was provided to the authors, Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, before information which corroborates what Skinner just said came out in a book by Mark Elliott, who authored a book about Cato Kalin. And it turns out that indeed O.J. Simpson had been getting death threats from white supremacist groups, that acquaintances on LAPD, it does not say sympathetic to the white supremacist cause, but that acquaintances in L.A. law enforcement had warned him and that the FBI knew about this. Turning to page 278 in Blood Oath, there is an excerpting of the book The Whole Truth by Mark Elliott about Cato Kalin, specifically on pages 244 and 245 of that book. We read, quoting from Blood Oath, which in turn quotes from The Whole Truth by Mark Elliott about Cato, quote, "O.J. told Cato he was worried about what he referred to only as, quote, some KKK group, unquote. He believed they, quote, unquote, were out to get him. Several times during the months Cato lived at his house, he told him about a group he knew of that hated blacks and Jews, and because he was black and an active fundraiser for several Jewish charitable organizations, he was a top target on their hit list. He was convinced his life was in danger and that, quote, they, unquote, wouldn't rest until he was dead. He told Cato he had heard about this from several of his detective friends and that the FBI had also been in contact to warn him. As a result, he said, he was constantly in fear of being hit. He said he told Nicole about it, but that she didn't believe him," unquote. And according to Stephen Wirth, this information came out after Skinner had told him about the warnings provided to O.J. Simpson by LAPD people or L.A. law enforcement people who knew him and were sympathetic to the white supremacist cause. Apparently, Nicole also had been receiving death threats from white supremacist groups. We're going to turn now to a book called Killing Time, subtitled Who Murdered Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman, the First Full Investigation. The book was co-authored by longtime intelligence community researcher Donald Freed, F-R-E-E-D, and Raymond Briggs, and was published in hardcover by the Macmillan Press and copyrighted 1996. And turning to page 148 in the book, we read the following concerning threats delivered to O.J. and Nicole by white supremacist groups. Both O.J. and Nicole tell Cato Kalin they had neo-Nazi threats by telephone and letter 1993 and 94. The terrorists target their interracial union and their ties to Jews. It should also be noted, right below that, O.J. tells a friend he found his kitchen door open late at night, June 11, 1994, the night before the murders. Inside, he finds a strange message on his answering machine, which seems to be in a foreign language. One of the things that Skinner told Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers was that a foreign terrorist group that had been conducting a race war in their own part of the world, which was causing problems with the U.S. and its allies, had helped to finance Operation Thunderbolt, the killing of Nicole and Ron, and the framing of O.J. Simpson. It's not made clear what that foreign terrorist group is, but from the context, it seems quite probable that that was a German Nazi group, quite possibly connected with some of the old guard from the Third Reich. I call that old guard the Underground Reich. We should note, too, that apparently, and one of the pieces of information that Skinner provided to Carl Jaspers and Stephen Wirth was that the Cause strike team had Nicole's and O.J.'s places electronically and physically surveilled, that both the intercoms and telephones of Nicole and O.J. had been tapped. They had O.J. and Nicole under physical surveillance and also electronic surveillance involving the most sophisticated equipment, including infrared night vision equipment. This is interesting because Nicole apparently felt that she was being observed by someone, and she asked O.J. and his friends to come by because she felt she was threatened. Turning to page 146 of Killing Time, we read, "Someone other than O.J. Simpson was focused on her, Nicole knew, because she reported to friends that she had seen people near her residence, and when she was driving, people who seemed suspicious and made her anxious. There were also telephone calls that were obscene, both sexually and racially. Calls that were so disturbing that she asked Simpson and several friends to drive by her condominium when they were in her neighborhood in the evening hours just to keep an eye on her and the children. This harassment helps explain information that came into the trial regarding Simpson's having been seen at night near her Gretna Green residence where she lived before moving to Bundy in 1994. Indeed, it does, I think, present a rather interesting take on O.J.'s presence around Nicole's place. What is significant about the allegations of white supremacist activity on the part of Mark Furman, that he was head of basically a white supremacist group within LAPD, the fact that O.J. Simpson and Nicole were getting written and telephone death threats from white supremacist groups, and according to Skinner and according to information provided to Cato Kalin and accessed by Mark Elliott, members of L.A. law enforcement had warned O.J. that his life was in danger from white supremacist groups. According to Skinner, some of these warnings came from members of L.A. law enforcement who were sympathetic to the cause. By the way, I want to refresh for veteran listeners' purposes. The information presented in a long series done in the spring of 1996 entitled Specialized Knowledge and Abilities, this refers to the tactic of Nazi elements and fascist elements worldwide of infiltrating the police and the military with the purposes of not only compromising and ultimately discrediting and turning those institutions, but also the purpose of acquiring, quote, specialized knowledge and abilities, unquote, to be eventually used to overthrow the democratic state. One of the things that's interesting about the apparent white supremacist activity on the part of Mark Furman, the fact that Lance Ito would not permit this into the trial, perhaps blocked a further investigation of this situation, and also the allegations that Mark Furman had some sort of personal relationship with Nicole, perhaps even a sexual relationship, is that when Mark Furman testified in the criminal trial, he didn't just perjure himself about the use of the N-word, but he also perjured himself about where he was and what he was doing the night of the killings. It is even possible that Marcia Clark was aware of this, although that has not been determined. Turning once again to the book Blood Oath by Stephen Wirth and Carl Jaspers, softcover Rainbow Books, copyright 1996, of the discrepancies between what Mark Furman said he was doing in court said he was doing on the night of June 12, 1994, and what he was actually doing, we read the following. Mark Furman claims to have attended a Police Protective League meeting as an official delegate that extended over Saturday, June 11th, and Sunday, June 12, 1994, the location being the La Quinta Resort in La Quinta, California, approximately 110 miles east of Los Angeles. La Quinta is capital L.A., capital Q-U-I-N-T-A. Saturday's schedule involved a general meeting from 8 o'clock. By the way, that was my interjection. Saturday's schedule involved a general meeting from 8 a.m. to 3 in the afternoon. In the evening, there was a reception starting at 7 p.m. at the tennis club and a barbecue dinner scheduled from 8 p.m. until 9:30 p.m. Sunday's agenda called for a general session meeting to be held from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., after which the league members checked out. Mark Furman gives possible perjured testimony on March 9, 1995, as he testified on the witness stand. Source, trial, March 9, 1995. Witness, Detective Mark Furman. Direct examination by Marcia Clark. And what follows is an actual excerpting of the Furman testimony in the criminal trial. On the evening of June 12, 1994, at approximately 8 p.m., oh, this is Marcia Clark's question, by the way, question. On the evening of June 12, 1994, at approximately 8 p.m., where were you? Answer. At approximately 8 p.m., I was in east of Palm Desert in La Quinta Resort at a Protective League seminar. Question. Was that a police officer's function, sir? Answer. Yes, I'm a delegate in the Protective League, or was at that time. Question. Okay, and at what time did you leave? Answer. I believe I left somewhere around 8 o'clock, just as the barbecue was starting. Question. And you left? When you left, you drove where? Answer. I drove to my home. Question. Remember what time you got home, sir? Answer. About 10:30. Question. And was there anyone home when you got there? Answer. My wife. Question. What time did you go to bed? Answer. I believe about 11 o'clock, maybe a little later. Mark Furman couldn't have left La Quinta on Sunday, June 12, 1994, because the barbecue was on Saturday. There was no barbecue on Sunday. Why did he use it as an alibi for his whereabouts, and why did Marcia Clark ask him where he was at 8 p.m.? Attorneys are taught never to ask a question unless you know the answer. Had she checked it out? Was she attempting to validate his alibi? A more potentially incriminating situation arises if Mark Furman's answer was based on his possible departure on Saturday the 11th, prior to the barbecue. Does it make sense for him to attend a session that ended at 3 p.m., hang around for 4 hours until drinks were served at 7 p.m., and then drive back to his home in Redondo Beach? On Saturday, June 12th, there was a general session meeting scheduled from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m. Since contract negotiations were taking place, one could assume that the delegates were meeting to discuss the acceptance or rejection of the city's latest wage offer that was the result of long, difficult negotiations. As a delegate, he was planning on leaving his house at 5:30 a.m. to drive back for that session. Or did he have more important business back in Los Angeles? Remember, Skinner claimed that the deliverer, he was the contact point for the strike team, was meeting with the Dark German on the day of the murders, June 12th. The Dark German, which coincidentally or otherwise rhymes with Mark Furman, is the code name that was given by Skinner and the authors to the insider that the Cause Group had within L.A. law enforcement, and there may have been more than one insider. We're going to continue with an analysis of Mark Furman, his possible white supremacist connections, and extend outward to other activity of that type being conducted around the country. That's all we have time for in this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.